From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. I guess in 1992, Sasha Gervais was so taken with the speed metal band Anvil that he decided to become a roadie. He was known as Teabag. And over 20 years later, he thought there was a film in their life. And when I saw the movie Anvil, the story of Anvil, which he directed, and it's a terrific film, by the way, John Lennon's song Working Class Hero came to mind for me. Did it for you as well, Sasha?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that was the appeal of these guys. It was actually 1982, I think it was, that I first met them. And I went on the road with them when I was 16. And, you know, they were always just these incredible guys. They were like atypical of the rock stars that you would meet at places like the Marquee in London, because they were just completely cool. You could talk to them. And when I hooked up with them 20 years later, you know, Lips was a catering driver for Choice Children's Catering in Scarborough, Ontario, and Rob was doing porch renovation, and they were still keeping this dream going. And I just thought, you know, it was very much like a working class hero story. It was a blue collar story.
I wish to say you're talking about Lips Kuto and Rob Reiner, who are basically the centerpiece of the band. And the story is, as much as anything, about friendship and about the beating a friendship can take.
Right. Yeah, it was an intense experience being with them for that period, the 2-year period that we shot the movie, because, you know, here they were having put in 30 years of work, you know, to try and build this dream that they'd had as, you know, 14-year-old kids. And when they were young, they'd made this pact that they were going to rock together forever, and it hadn't quite worked out. They'd nearly made it in the 80s and certainly had gained notoriety and influence within their field, but they'd never broken big. And I think they were still going for it, and there was just something incredibly inspiring. I mean, on one hand, it was like, are they nuts? But on the other hand, it was like, well, how many people stay that pure and that true to a dream they had as kids? And I think it was that duality that was, it was a little bit like Fitzcarraldo. It was, that's what made the story interesting, that these guys who simply refused to quit, even when, you know, to all intents and purposes, to the rest of the world, it was over. There's a point where, you know, they've just been going for it, and then all this stuff happens, and they're blocked yet again. And finally, you know, one of Rob Reiner's sister says, you know, it's over. It's been over for a long time. And in a strange way, that helped the ending of the film, which obviously I won't reveal. But it you know, not only was the world conspiring to shut them out, but their own family members were like, hey, guys, you got to wake up. And I think it just made you root for them more.
It's funny because, I mean, I just think about this, and it's such a great story because, I mean, certainly you make the allusion to Spinal Tap, not only with the title, the redundant great title, but also the first 10 minutes of the movie. It's, yeah, it's almost kind of a reiteration of Spinal Tap, but then you move it past that, at which point the laughs almost immediately stop, and we know these guys.
I think, you know, given the fact that the director of Spinal Tap is called Rob Reiner and the drummer of Anvil is also called Rob Reiner, I think we were kind of screwed right out of the gate. There was no way we were going to evade the specter of Spinal Tap. So we just thought, you know what, we're going to embrace it. I mean, and it's not like we didn't have the material to kind of, you know, to make the comparison. I mean, when I sat down with them and they talked about the first song they'd ever wrote called Thumb Hang about the Spanish Inquisition, it was like, well, you could never make it up. And so they started going through the song, like, on film. And it was just one of those spontaneous moments where so much of what's in the film just sort of, I didn't even know until the moment it was filmed. And we caught those moments. It was very fresh and very spontaneous. And it naturally lent itself to that Spinal Tap comparison. So we essentially decided to, you know, say to the audience, okay, look, these guys are kind of like Spinal Tap, of course, except they're real. And then as you so rightly indicate, 30 or 40 minutes into the movie, the whole tone of the film shifts. And I think that it was a really good Trojan horse for us in a way that we could convey to the audience, you know, you're going to have a fun night out. Hopefully you're going to be entertained. But also, there's more meaningful stuff here. I don't think people would have walked into a movie about two kind of 50-year-old headbangers from Toronto thinking this is going to be a portrait of perseverance and friendship and family. You know, I don't think the audience wouldn't have gone along with it. So Spinal Tap, in a way, was really helpful to us. And it's like, I hope that from our perspective, filmmaking perspective, we were coming from the place of, look, you know, you want to be as truthful and honest as any good friend will be. And so I told them the truth, you know, which they knew. You guys are funny. You know, I mean, Lips came on stage when I first saw him in a bondage harness and he played his Flying V guitar with a marital aid. I mean, you know, and a chainsaw he had in his act. So at an Anvil show, you were always like laughing as hard as you were banging your head.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director Sasa Gervais. His film is Anvil, The Story of Anvil. And we should say, too, what the Marquee Club was like in those days. It was basically a place where also sort of the post-punk and new wave bands kind of came to play. All these guys in lots of makeup and costumes. So to get guys that basic who were really about the music must have been a real breath of fresh air at that place.
Absolutely. I mean, it was great. I mean, the thing about Anvil when they first appeared on the scene in 82 was they were different. They were doing that very intense speed metal thing, that thrash beat, which for those musicians out there is essentially eighth notes fired incredibly quick on bass drum and bass guitar at the same time. And that thing that ultimately became the blueprint for Metallica sound and the other bands that followed like Anthrax and Megadeth was something that Anvil was really doing for the first time. And Lars Ulrich, when we interviewed him for the film, sort of went on for about half an hour about it. And it was an amazing time growing up and seeing bands like Anvil, but they were the ones that stood out. And obviously what made them stand out even more for me personally was when I met them, they'd never been to London, and I showed them around, and I had the pleasure of taking Lipton, Rob Reiner to Westminster Abbey and the Tate Gallery, which was quite
You took them to the Tate?
I took them to the Tate, and I introduced Rob Reiner to the work of Francis Bacon, which again was another great cultural event. If you see in the film, and it was amazing, and they were so cool with me, and they were like, hey, do you want to come out on the road? So I ended up being Anvil's roadie on the Backwaxed, Forged in Fire and Strength of Steel tours in the early 80s, and you know, it was like they gave me the experience of a lifetime, being on the road with my favorite band. What was interesting was coming back from my school holidays the first time, and all my boring friends had been on extremely dull, you know, French cycling tours of Normandy, you know, and I'd had my first sexual experience in the parking lot of a Quebec hockey arena with a bakery manageress called Valerie. They were just very jealous.
In watching these guys play in the movie, what's amazing is seeing guys that age still playing like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, the immense amount of physical intensity that it takes, you get exhausted just a few songs we see those guys playing in the film. And I wonder if you had a sense of how that would communicate as you were shooting it.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, it was originally conceived actually as a two-part project. When I sat down on my Uncle Marty's couch in Toronto in 2005 and I sat down with Lips and I said, listen, man, I want to make a movie. The whole idea was that it would be a film where it wasn't a concert film where we showed too much of the music, but people would get a sense, and then the band would come out live right there in the theater and play. So it was originally conceived almost as a live event. And I knew that the surprise would be, oh my God, these guys can really play. And as you say, you do get a sense of it in the film, but when you actually see them play, they're incredible because they've been doing it for 30 years. And I think the reason they have that energy is because they've been doing it so long. Like Lip says, it's the lifeblood. It's the thing that keeps him young, is being able to play, you know, as often as possible.
It seems like all the frustrations they have in their lives as day laborers, they bring to the stage. So that gives them a kind of an extra fuel for the fire, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, like Lip says at the beginning of the film, for all the stuff he has to go through, he has Anvil to give him his happiness. I mean, he said to me a couple of times, you know, if he didn't have the band as an outlet, he thinks he would have gone insane. There was no way that he would have given up on that dream. And, you know, what was momentous about them was that they still believed, you know, even when they were playing bars, you know, in Quebec, like the Horseshoe Tavern, they still believed they had a shot at making it big. And that's what was really astonishing when I hooked up with them again in 2005 after 20 years, was to discover that same fire and passion that they'd had, that I'd remembered when I was 15, 16 years old, was still there. They were not only thrilled that they'd had an influence on bands like Metallica, but they simultaneously believed that their day would come. And there was something so insane and wonderful about it. I thought, there's a film there. And it's sort of like Rocky with Marshall amplifiers, I guess, as Michael Moore calls it.
What's fascinating about watching the movie is watching what different guys they are when they're not on stage.
That's right.
And when they're not, or forget that, when they don't walk into an arena, it's like their physical postures change, they become different people. And it's almost like, at this point, it's not just the performance, it's an addiction for them. And you kind of touch on this in some ways in the film, too.
I think it is. I think that, you know, you said it absolutely right. They have a specific stage persona that runs in direct opposition often to who they really are. I mean, who they really are is sort of the nice sons of Jewish immigrants. In Rob Reiner's case, the son of a survivor of Auschwitz. And, you know, the two different family stories I think are incredibly intriguing. And for me as a filmmaker, were the most interesting aspects of making the film, were discovering those things. And I think, though, that without the stage personas, they wouldn't. It is a kind of addiction, and Lips has talked of it in those terms. It's like, who am I without the persona? Like, it would be, in a sense, like giving up himself, or, you know, cutting off his own arm. He just couldn't do it. He can't survive without that persona.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the director of Anvil, The Story of Anvil, Sasha Gervaisi. And what you've made here, and I wonder when it's occurred to you, because it takes a while before the film gets to it, is a film really about obsession, about these guys who are determined to wrestle this thing called performance to the ground. After a while, it's almost like the idea of being successful is kind of secondary.
That's right.
It's just they've got to get this stuff out.
They've got to do it regardless. I mean, they hope that they're successful. They want success. They certainly are going for it. But at a certain point, they are absolutely obsessed. And I mean, it was just so intriguing and fascinating to be around people who, you know, what is the difference between, you know, success and failure? You know, if they'd failed, they would have just been completely insane. You know, but if they succeed, they're total geniuses. You know, the point being that they really refused to let it go. They were obsessed, and they are obsessed. And I didn't realize going into the film that it would be about that. I didn't realize it would really be about this longstanding friendship between Lips and Rob. I thought initially it would be, you know, just about this incredible character, Lips, who I knew. As the film revealed itself and unfolded over the 2 years that we shot it, I suddenly got, in touch with what it needed to be about, which was these incredible themes of perseverance and family and just refusing to give up on something, even though everyone in the world is telling you you're insane.
But the other thing I was so moved by in the movie, Sasha, is just that they're different people when they're apart.
Absolutely. I mean, you see, Lips is just a really quiet kind of family man, you know, and he really is amazing with his wife and son. And Rob is a little bit more enigmatic, but again, you know, they both have children. And that's what made it fascinating was you couldn't really categorize them because, you know, on one hand, they're just the nice Jewish boys, sons of, you know, immigrants into Canada. On another hand, they're obsessed individuals. On another hand, they're like 14-year-old kids who won't give up on a dream. On another hand, there's these tragicomic figures, you know, who the world derides at a certain point. So they just, you know, they were open to so many different interpretations, and I thought that dramatically was going to be intriguing because people, like you rightly say, begin almost laughing at them, and I think the film encourages that to a degree because they're funny. But by the end, the same audience that's going ha ha ha, aren't they kind of like Spinal Tap? Is I think authentically moved by the fact that whatever you think of heavy metal or them, they're absolutely connected with their dreams and they're really doing it for real. And how many people sort of live that purely in a sense, even though, you know, they're wearing fanny packs and you're laughing at me, which, by the way, I don't really understand why they wear fanny packs, but they do.
They're Canadian. What else do they do? But part of the thing that's so fascinating about the movie, too, is just that, and you must have come close to this and moved away from it, at no point does it become maudlin.
Yeah, because they're not. You know, I think they've always had a sense of humor about the circumstances.
But certainly the circumstances themselves they teeter into the maudlin.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is the film, I think, like any part of life, it encompasses incredibly funny things, you know, hilarious things, and really tough, hard things. And the reality of, you know, maybe these guys aren't going to make it at a certain point. Maybe it is time to give up and kind of, you know, unplug the guitar and go home. But, you know, it's only part of the story. It's not the whole story. I think that it touches on so many different tones, and one minute it's just hilarious, and the next minute, you know, Lips can get extremely emotional and serious, and it's that disparity and extreme difference in tones all thrown together that makes it, I think, so dramatically fertile. I mean, just spend half an hour with Anvil and you'll see what I mean. It's like more than once, I mean, multiple times I've had people say after they meet them, oh my God, it's just like being in the movie. It never stops.
Well, we'll take a break. We have at least a half an hour to talk about Anvil, The Story of Anvil, with my guest, director Sasha Gervaisi. It's film, and it's really remarkable. By the way, you listen to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. More to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. I'm talking to Sasha Gervaisi about his great film, Anvil, The Story of Anvil. And I can't help it, Sasha. As I was watching the movie, I kept thinking of Beckett. for some reason. I have no idea why.
Well, I don't know who it was, but a reviewer in England described Lipson Rob as the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of metal as well. So,
but I just was thinking about, there's a great essay that Beckett wrote about Proust, and he talks about the way time is just an inflexible and impermanent thing, yet you're always trying to get your hands around
it. That's right. And I think that Anthony Lane was the one who pointed out that, you know, ultimately the movie's about, you know, time and how over time it fades you out like a song on the radio. And I thought it was just so beautifully put. And it's totally true. It's that scene in the film where Lips, you know, says to the camera, you know, if we don't make it now, it's maybe never going to happen. And it was just the stakes right there. He's put everything out on the line. And it's like, there's this one window and they've got to go for it if they're ever going to have a chance of realizing the dream. And it's very intense experience. And I think that absolutely, you know, us making the film in a way articulated their circumstances for them. You know, when someone's making a movie about you, it's like, well, I better start thinking about what's going on in my life. And I think they realized that this was it. There was never going to be another time when a movie was going to be made. And there was never going to be another time when they would go for it to this extent. And that's what they did. But what's such a sweet thing that's going on now is post the film and the band coming out and playing and people going, oh my God, they're actually a really good band. They've suddenly began to be successful. They suddenly have a real manager and a real lawyer and a real booking agent. It's this incredible sort of Cinderella story where all these other bands are embracing them. They were on page one of Rolling Stone. They've been on Jimmy Kimmel. You know, they're being, in a way, celebrated for sticking it in for 30 years. But just the fact that they're just, like you said, going back to your story about blue-collar working-class story, about these guys who just had a dream, haven't given up on it, and now they've put in all the hard work. And in an era where, you know, these plastic throwaway bands last a year and a half, 2 years, here are guys who really deserve the acclaim. And I think people are really enjoying giving it to them.
As they were getting started, there was a whole era of kind of bands that were all representation and plastic throwaway and guys who couldn't play their instruments. They were ahead of their time in that way. I mean, for them, it was strictly about the music. I mean, certainly the presentational aspect was a show-busy thing for them, but the musicianship was what was important. And in 1982, people kind of weren't ready for that.
That's right. They were like a year. Anvil is notoriously too early or too late. And they were a year ahead of the curve. And I think what happened was the biggest rock manager in the world decided to sign them and said, you guys are great, but, you know, you should stop doing all that speedy stuff. And they had another manager, a guy called Johnny Z, who owned a record store in New Jersey, who was going, Anvil is the future of heavy metal. And while the biggest manager in the world was telling them to kind of soften up their sound, Johnny Z, the manager of the record store in New Jersey, sort of got bored waiting around for Anvil to figure themselves out, went to San Francisco and found a little band called Metallica. And it really does underline the fact that sometimes life can boil down to a moment. It's sort of like sliding doors. And at a crucial moment, they just missed making the connection they needed to make. But as Lips has said to me recently, you know, it needed to happen that way for it to come back 30 years later. The great thing is, I think that if it had happened for them at that point, you know, like most bands in their 20s, they would have lost their minds and lost perspective and maybe even broken up. But, you know, they stayed together for 30 years and now they're really enjoying every morsel of what's going on. They really appreciate it and see it for what it is. It's like Lips came up with this great analogy. He said, it's like, you know, you've done a prize fight and you're in this arena and you've gone 13 rounds and you're lying on the floor, bloody, knocked out. You know, everyone's left the arena and an hour and a half later, an official runs in and says, oh, by the way, you won. So, I mean, they thought it was over. So the fact that it's not, and they're getting the support they're getting from all these incredible artists from, you know, every band from Coldplay to David Byrne to Maroon 5 to Henry Rollins. I mean, all these people have come out of the woodwork just supporting the band. And also their incredibly exemplary, I think, dedication to the cause.
I know we were joking about Canada a moment ago, but I thought that one of the things that's probably kept them going is that's such a benevolent country that you can do this thing and still imagine there's a place for you somewhere else. I mean, part of Canada is, if you're an artist, hoping that you break through and break out of that place. Whereas, had they been in America still, had they stayed, had they come here and not made it, I think it would have broken them in some ways.
Yeah, I think there's something about the Canadian culture that absolutely celebrates that sort of steadfast stick-to-itiveness, but without being particularly, you know, flashy. You know, there is this thing about just, you know, doing a good job steadily and not, you know, complaining too much. I agree with you. I think had they made the move to America, the story would have been very different. Ultimately, you know, had they made it, you know, quote unquote, in 82, 83, there really wouldn't have been a movie to make. The movie was really about the narrative of in the present of these guys 30 years later still going for it with the same passion and need. And obviously the stakes being, you know, raised by the fact that, you know, they're in their 50s now and there's a clock running. Like you said earlier, there's a time limitation. This was the moment. And we were, I think, extremely fortunate to be able to capture that moment in time.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director Sasa Gervaisi. His film is Anvil, The Story of Anvil. I can attest to that the screening at Sundance that I saw where people kind of are looking at each other like, why don't I know these guys, to falling in love with them, to just being moved to stand up. And there's a kind of excitement that the movie generates that can only be connected to rock and roll in some ways.
Right. And it was amazing for us. I mean, you were at that screening when we premiered. It was 600 people and there was a standing ovation. And then we trooped out into the snow. And they were playing their signature tune, Metal on Metal, out of the back of a van, and all these people huddled up in like minus 10. And I remember this Park City school teacher, I think she was about 60 or 65, came up and she bought Anvil's album, This Is 13, and she said, "Lips, Rob, I will never listen to this record, but I just want to help you." And she bought like 3 copies of the record, and it was just like, what's going on?
I know that as a screenwriter, you have to think in a very linear way and figure out how the character is going to play into the narrative that you've worked out. But in something like this, when you're just shooting and shooting and shooting, at what point do you start to say, this is where my story is? Was it during the shooting, or was it as you cutting things together? Or I wonder how that happened for you, because this is a very different discipline, isn't it?
Very different. All I knew going in is that my initial thing was that Lips was just this extraordinary sort of surreal, larger-than-life character who almost could have been found in, you know, Commedia dell'arte. I mean, you just can't believe that he's real, but yet he is. And he's so hard on his sleeve and without filter and in touch with his emotion that he was just such a compelling, I think, heart to the film. And as the film evolved, it became clear that it was really about the friendship between Lips and Rob that went back to childhood. And this was really ultimately, you know, a love story between two men in one sense, and about how they're closer to one another than any other people in their lives. So that became clear. And then in terms of the structure of the film, obviously there was this tour and this record. And at a certain point, we just didn't know what to do. So you just try and put out cards and try and work out, well, how will this come? But we shot for a year before we began editing, and then we simultaneously shot and edited for a year. So the whole process was just over 2 years. But it really was something where, with a documentary, I know people who've started off making a movie and then they've got into it, you know, 40 hours of footage, and they've got, there's no movie here. So it's just a question of having an instinct. And I just had an instinct. And also because of the connection between me and Lips and Rob going back to when I was a kid, I just also knew there was something special there. We'd had such amazing times. I knew that once people got past their funny heavy metal guys and they actually started to understand what incredible people they were, I knew that the audience might be connected in a different way to the one they'd been anticipating walking into the film. But it was a lot of work. I mean, it was not, you know, it didn't just lay itself out. You know, it took some time until we could organize it and make it make sense as a story.
This must have been an enormously liberating experience for you, because as a teenager, you got to see that, you know, there were unknown worlds that were open to you if you just investigated those rather than running away from them. But coming back to that, you could just see this thing that must have set off a spark in you, that still this fire that was still going worlds away from you.
And it was amazing. I mean, the gift that I got from it was I was able to be 15 again. I was able to go back into my childhood and discover that everything and everyone was not just sort of the same as I'd remembered it, but exactly the same as I remember. In fact, Lips and Rob had not changed their clothes since 1984. So it was sort of like a living acid trip. It was just extraordinary, because I was able to really relive and rethink and kind of have that energy again. And I think that energy that I felt is hopefully communicated in the film. And what was liberating about the whole process was, you know, having worked, you know, within the studio system, you know, I was able to then go off and direct my own film. I wasn't part of like a huge machine, but I was able to sort of do it my way on my terms. And it was really a great experience. It was an adventure for me to do it that way. And I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I broke the cardinal rule of all rules in the film business, which is I paid for the film myself. And I didn't really want to. But what happened was, when I hooked up with the boys again in the summer of 2005, they'd already met the manager, Tiziana, who was booking the tour. And I knew that here we are in the middle of the summer where everyone's away on holiday. I just didn't have the time to go and like pitch a studio and, hey, I've got this great idea about these heavy metal guys. And it's a documentary. You know, they would just laugh me out of town. So I had like 4 weeks to decide before this tour happened whether I was going to go get a crew and just go make this movie. And in the end, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And it was crazy, but it wasn't so crazy at the end of the day, because I sort of knew that if it came off right, that we had a chance of making a special movie. And I feel so proud of what's happened with the guys. I just love seeing them live, man, and seeing all these kids lining up for their autographs. It makes me really happy because I was one of those kids, you know.
By the way, it's the treatment. I'm talking to Sasha Gervais about his incredible movie Anvil, the story of Anvil. But I just have to wonder if that aspect of being able to control this thing and build it until you wanted to make it without really getting notes and being told, and we should say that our mutual friend Rebecca Yeldon was your producer. And,
by the way, very smart and
very resourceful producer.
And could not have made the film without her. And again, it's all about the people that you work with. And Rebecca was just extraordinary. You couldn't have asked for someone who gave more and was more understanding intuitively of what the story was. When I took her out to dinner to say, hey, Rebecca, you know, I've got this story about heavy metal, her first response was, oh my God, let's order. You know, she was not interested in heavy metal at all. But she immediately, once I began to tell her the story of Lips and Rob and my connection with them, she intuited instantly that, okay, this is a story that's not about heavy metal. It's really about friendship and this incredible dream. And she was just extraordinary from day one. And so, again, it's about being fortunate enough to find collaborators who not only are brilliant, you know, creatively, but also down for the adventure with you. And she was certainly both.
You've written screenplays that have gone through the development process in the studio system. There's something, it's got to be enormously unsatisfying about that as compared to doing this thing that sort of grabbed you by the heart and dragged you along.
Well, I look at it as my day job. I have an incredibly good day job where I get paid incredibly well to make stuff up. So, you know, and in fact, it's such a good day job that I actually can go off and make my own feature film. So I'm not going to be complaining too much about it. It's a wonderful thing to have, you know. Obviously, I've worked with a lot of really interesting people. I've had some great experiences working with actors and on sets, and it's just been amazing. So all of those skills have enabled me to be at the point where I could kind of go off and make Anvil. And that's sort of how I want to do it moving forward, is make, you know, things that I really love that probably don't cost that much money, and then also kind of work within the system, and, you know, whatever happens, happens. But generally, you know, like Lips and Anvil, I have my little movies that I can make. And Anvil just was a sort of side project for fun. And I think that it's great how those things, where there's no pressure, where there's no one giving you notes and you can do it your way, it's funny how those things sort of tend to turn out the best sometimes, because you're coming from a place of delight and joy and you're doing it for its own sake. You're not doing it, you know, to make money or whatever. You're just doing it because you love doing it. I mean, that's why I got into the film business, was to make movies that I love, you know, that I want to see.
Well, Sasha, you may want to think of lots of people love, including me, and thank you so much for doing this. We're out of time.
Thank you so much, Elvis. It's awesome, man.
Director Sasha Gervais, his great film is Anvil, the story of Anvil. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Paul Ruest at the Argo Network. Bob Carlson is our editor, Gemma Dempsey, the producer. If you'd like to comment on this show, and I'm sure you will, please post those thoughts at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.